Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen is the National Incident Commander for the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. He joins me in the studio to talk about the latest on the disaster, what the Obama administration is doing to help those most affected. You are invited to join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you, Admiral. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Diane. It's great to be here.
You met with BP claims officials yesterday. What did you ask for?
We asked for quite a bit. Actually, I'd sent a letter the day before requesting the meeting. And what we want is access to their data files regarding claims. We want to verify the information that they're providing us in terms of when claims are received, how fast they're being acted upon, and our ability to get a more comprehensive communications package out to the folks who need to file claims. And in addition to that, there are three general areas where people or entities can file claims: individuals for loss of income, businesses because of the economic impact on their businesses, and state and local governments. We focused on the first two in our meeting yesterday. It was a detailed meeting. It was headed by Tracy Waring, who leads my integrated services team, and we had the right people there from British Petroleum. We're going to have a series of meetings moving forward, but we're going to try and make this data transparent and be able to make sure we got quality control over the claims process.
Of course, you don't know when calls go in that are not returned. This morning on Morning Edition, we heard from a man named Neil Webster in Orange Beach, Alabama. He described making 84 calls to British Petroleum claims line since last Friday, never getting a call back.
Well, that's the sort of thing we want to uncover. We want to get to the bottom of it. Was a call made? Was it received? Responsible party being responsible, and we gave them a list of probably 20 or 30 data elements that we required to understand the status of the claims and be transparent with the states and the public, and we're in the process of having a follow-on meeting this morning to do just that.
Do they have to do what you tell them to do?
In effect, yes. The National Incident Commander and the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, by law, direct the cleanup and everything associated with that. So I sent a letter to Tony Hayward, and we got the meeting, and we're moving forward. It was time to get the information out there and serve the American public the best we can. That's
there are a lot of people wondering, Admiral Allen, why and how you were chosen to be the National Incident Commander.
Well, we had an interesting situation when the explosion first occurred. It was on the 20th of April. We were in the process of going through a leadership change in the Coast Guard. I was about ready to be relieved as a commandant at the end of my four-year term. And all the other officers that were going to be reassigned were all changing command at the time. Under the current construct, normally the commandant of the Coast Guard would pick one of his three-star area commanders to be the National Incident Commander. But everybody was in movement except me.
So I guess
when music stopped, there was no chair.
Now, how much do you know, or did you know, about oil spills before this incident?
I worked my first major oil spill in 1980 when I was a lieutenant. I'm a former federal on-scene coordinator and a captain of the port in the Coast Guard, and I've been working oil spill-related events probably for about 30 years.
Good. I wanted to know that, and I'm sure our listeners did too. You said again and again that what you want from BP is more transparency, but we haven't seen that kind of transparency coming from BP yet. They are still claiming, for example, that they have no record of any plumes whatsoever beneath the ocean, and yet it would seem that there have been many such reports. What's your reaction?
Well, the reports on the plumes were actually made by research vessels from universities in the Gulf area. And what they did was they went out and they were sampling the water at various depths to find any presence of hydrocarbons. And we've just finished the evaluation of some of those researchers. I think University of South Florida was the one that we reported. And we found trace elements of hydrocarbons there. And some of them were actually fingerprinted to the deep water horizon. I worked very closely with Jane Lubchenco, who is the administrator of NOAA. What she is doing now, she's got a multi-vessel sampling plan where they're going out and trying to take different slices of the water in the Gulf. If you can imagine, almost like trying to take an MRI of the water column and test for traces of hydrocarbons at certain depths. So they're going to take the information that was provided by the university vessels, augment that with research being done by NOAA vessels, and in the next few weeks kind of create what I would call a three-dimensional picture of the of what's going on in the Gulf out there.
Why is BP claiming no plumes?
Well, they can claim whatever they want. We know what we know. And I'm not sure I'd call it a plume. It's more of a collection of a density of hydrocarbons. It's more like a mist or an underwater mist. It's not a real thick oil. It's very thin. And the issues that raises, whether it's coming from the top down or maybe as a result of the dispersants being applied at the leak point at the bottom of the ocean. But quite frankly, as far as getting that information and evaluating it, I would just assume an independent third party be doing that. And Jane Lubchenco's got a very good sampling plan going on right now. We're anxious to see where that takes us.
Okay. What's the difference if there is actually a plume or is not a plume?
Well, we need to know if there are hydrocarbons that we can't see below the surface and what concentration they might be there, because we don't know what the impacts might be on the fish and wildlife, marine mammals, and so forth. We also need to try and understand as best as we can how it got there. We're using dispersants on the surface. There's some natural degradation of oil because it will slowly bioremediate. We don't know if it's sinking, and we've been using subsea dispersants at 5,000 feet on the seafloor for the first time in history. And whether or not what doesn't get dispersed gets to the surface or enters the water column, I think those are all questions that are hanging out there that we need to answer.
How concerned are you about those dispersants on the ocean floor?
Well, let me say on dispersants, they're far less toxic than the oil. So you're trading off different demons. We've never used dispersants at the level we've used in this response. On the surface and below, it's approaching a million gallons. We, after the Exxon Valdez, put protocols in place where we could use dispersants. There was a lot of discussion after the Exxon Valdez spill whether or not they should be used, and they waited so long to get the approvals that they never were allowed to use them, nor could they be effective. After the Exxon Valdez, we put in pre-approval protocols where if certain conditions were met in terms of the sea state, the winds, and the currents and so forth, they could be applied without any interagency consultation. And that's what we began on this. But as we started to put so much dispersant out there, I know Lisa Jackson, my good friend at EPA, has concerns about even if it's lower toxicity, the buildup in the water column, what we don't know. When you decide to use dispersants, you're actually trading off the impact of the oil in the water rather than on shore. And it's a deal with the devil, quite frankly. But I think what we need to understand moving forward is we've had to use the dispersants. It was the best alternative we had. But what is the impact of that? And we have some water sampling protocols that have been set up so we can learn what the impact of the dispersants is, both on the subsea and on the surface.
And, of course, you mentioned the fowl and wildlife being affected. How concerned are you about the numbers of creatures being affected by this oil spill?
Well, I think anybody would say even one is too many. And we have found some turtles and marine mammals and so forth that have washed up on the beach that were dead. We're trying to figure out whether or not that is a natural attrition, because that does happen with certain species, or is it a result of the hydrocarbons? So we're doing necropsies on the carcasses we find that we're still able to for how long they've been on the beach. And we're going to be doing some in-depth sampling to try and figure out what the cause of death was and whether or not it was related to the oil spill.
How long does it take to do those studies?
They're in progress right now. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly what the length is, but it's very similar to a human autopsy. So there are some tests that do take a while to be completed.
Yesterday, or I gather it was Wednesday, President Obama told a television audience that he had not met with BP CEO Tony Hayward. He had not talked to him. He had not met with him. Have you talked with him directly and or met with him?
Both. I talk with him daily and sometimes several times during the day. When if I have concerns, if we have information requirements, if I need them to do something and I feel it's not being done at a lower level, I have complete access to him. We have met personally, and I will continue to do that throughout the entire spill.
What kinds of reactions, responses are you getting from him?
Well, just day before yesterday, I called him and I said, Tony, this claims process, and I know you're concerned about it, and you said publicly you want this to work. I think what we need to understand is the claims process that you're using may or may not be doing the best job that we both think. So I'm going to send you a letter, and I'm going to demand some data. I'm going to demand a meeting, and then we're going to jointly go out and see how it's really working in the field. And if it needs to be fixed, it's going to get fixed. So those are the types of conversations I have with him.
And what types of conversations do you have with President Obama?
Well, I meet with him frequently. I briefed him many, many times personally. Every time he's gone to the Gulf, I am with him. I have complete access to his staff, including Carol Browner, who is a specialist on climate change and energy. I have access when I need it, and I feel very comfortable with that.
You know, it's very interesting that the president's been criticized for somehow not having a strong enough or quick enough reaction to this bill.
Well, I can tell you by his interactions with me, the questions I get, which are sometimes very in-depth and very technical.
Such as?
He will drill down very, very far on how we do the flow rate estimates, the oil that's coming out. He wants to know about oil skimming technology. He wants to know about oil cleanup. He wants to know about what types of boom are more effective than others. He really drills down.
Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen, he's National Incident Commander for the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. When we come back, we'll talk further, take your calls, your messages. I look forward to hearing from you. And here's our first message from Facebook for Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen. It's from Charlene. She says, I'd like to know if Admiral Allen has a due date in mind for a response to his letter to BPO CEO Hayward, and if that is not met, what penalties will be assessed?
Well, we actually sent two letters in the last 72 hours. One was on the claims data. The other one was on our request for them to come up with a containment strategy for taking the oil that's coming out of the wellhead and actually provide not only a single system but a redundant system. So if one went down, we could continue to produce. We gave them 72 hours to respond to that. I actually got the letter back at about 10 o'clock last night. And it's under review right now, so they met their deadline.
They met their deadline. Have you looked at that letter?
I looked at it. It appears to be responsive, but we're having our technical experts and our engineers looking at it right now. Probably have an announcement later on in the day or tomorrow about everything that's in that letter. But, yes, they've been responsive.
All right. Yesterday, Capitol Hill heard Kevin Costner testify, an actor whom you know well. What did he have to offer, and what do you know about his equipment?
Well, first of all, I do know Kevin very well. He played a rescue swimmer in a movie called The Guardian several years ago. He's actually an honorary senior chief in the Coast Guard, and we admire Kevin very much. He's been involved with a company that's producing equipment that actually separates oil from water, and there are a lot of different technologies out there that do that. My understanding is that he's been working with British Petroleum, and they're close to making a decision, or they may have already made a decision on his equipment. If I could, for the public, might I tell you how you can offer suggestions?
Please.
We have a site that we've set up for the response. It's called deepwaterhorizonresponse.com, words all together. And if you go there, there's an icon that says suggestion. That will take you to a website where you can propose technologies. We've also put out a solicitation for businesses to put in three-page papers of abstracts that we could take a look at. And we have been promising to review those within 5 days and give them the answer whether or not it's applicable or not and where we might bring it forward.
Tell me how much oil is currently being siphoned.
That's really hard to tell because it varies with the conditions every day. What we try and do with the oil that's on the surface is one of three things. We try and do if we the best thing we can do is an in situ burn. If we can pull it in an area and then light it on fire, that gets rid of most of the oil. We have to wait, make sure that for air quality that we meet the protocols, and that includes the direction and the wind speed. After that, we do mechanical skimming. These are vessels out there that actually go through and pull out the oil and the water together, then separate it, and then we decant the oil. The third is the use of dispersants. We've tried to limit that on the surface to only where it's needed for safety or operational exigencies. A reason for that would be the area around the Discoverer Enterprise, which is the one that's actually producing the oil from the wellhead right now. The oil actually comes up around that ship, and it produces a volatile organic compounds or the vapors that come off the oil. And that needs to be suppressed from time to time for worker safety. You can do that with dispersants or by putting a water blanket over it. So that's another reason we would use dispersants. And then finally, some of this oil actually evaporates. And in the summertime, with the high temperatures we have down there, we're actually getting some help from Mother Nature in that regard.
How much are you concerned about worker safety?
We're very concerned about worker safety, not only the folks that are out on the well site, but the folks that are working along the beaches. In fact, to that end, just earlier this week, we signed an agreement with the Department of Labor and OSHA on how we were going to team with them. They're with our command post down in the Gulf. They're out doing enforcement and inspections on the vessels, on the cleanup workers, and making sure that we're protecting them not only from volatile organic compounds, but just tripping hazards, sharp edges on ships and things like that. But we have a very comprehensive program with OSHA.
But how are you protecting them?
Well, you do it with personal protective equipment. You make sure they have the right equipment on, whether it's gloves or respirators or the types of protective clothing that they need. And in some cases, if it's not safe to operate, you don't even have them out there at all. We had a case a week or so ago with some of the fishing vessels that were working for us there. The folks on board started experiencing dizziness and nausea, and at that point, we just pulled all the boats back. Because you don't want to take a chance on safety. They'd gone into some area where there were some kind of fumes, and so we erred on the side of safety and just pulled everybody off the water.
We've heard some questions raised on this program about the connection between the development of ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, coming into the people who have worked on oil rigs, who have worked to try to clean up these kinds of spills. One caller told us about being at Cleveland Clinic and running into a number of individuals from Saudi Arabia who were being treated for ALS, who had been working in the oil industry. What can you tell us about that connection?
I'm not personally aware of that, but since you made a note, my staff may be, and we may have included that in our agreement with the folks that are working in occupational health and safety. I will certainly go back and check on that, though. That's an intriguing notion, and I had not heard of it.
Thank you. Yeah. All right. And to what extent is the Coast Guard, to what extent is there coordination among all the agencies working on the spill, working on the environment, working on wildlife?
Diane, that's a great question. If I could take just a minute and kind of explain to everybody, because I think the structure by which we're executing this response, I don't think is well known to the American public. The way we respond to an oil spill is through something called the National Contingency Plan. That was actually created in law by the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, which was passed in the wake of the Exxon Valdez. It is actually formally issued in regulations by EPA. And the way we respond to oil spills and chemical spills in this country is that if it's inland, EPA has the lead. If it's on the water, the Coast Guard has the lead. And whoever is directing the response is called the Federal On-Scene Coordinator. That is actually a legal term, and it gives them the legal authority to direct and compel compliance, and that's how we issue the orders to British Petroleum. So to compare and contrast to the Department of Defense, which a lot of people tend to do, in the Department of Defense, you have a monolithic chain of command. When I came in the Coast Guard, I had to memorize the chain of command from myself to the president every time I was asked. When we move outside DOD and we're looking at incidents of national significance, whether it be a hurricane or whether it's an oil spill or an earthquake, what you're really trying to do is get unity of effort, because the different departments have statutory authorities and mission responsibilities, and they can't walk away from those, but you have to aggregate that and trying to produce some synergy out of that. For instance, both NOAA and the Fish and Wildlife Service have purview over living creatures in the ocean. Fisheries are managed by NOAA, but marine mammals and endangered species they're managed by the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Interior. So when you're dealing with wildlife, they both have to be at the table. You can't preempt their authorities and jurisdictions because they both have responsibilities. What you really want to do is create unity of effort. And frankly, that's my job description, unity of effort.
What about economic liability? Whose purview is that?
Well, you're raising a great point, Diane. You know, I've worked oil spills over the years. I've never seen a spill like this. It's anomalous. It's complex. It's extraordinary in its magnitude. And right now, it's indeterminate. There's no end. You know, it's omnidirectional. The wind can blow the oil any direction. When you start moving to the areas where there's economic deprivation, we have recourse in law for people to submit claims, and we've talked about that. When you get into larger issues of the national economic impact, we've never had a spill that approached this order of magnitude that went way beyond what I would call the operational response and the things you do to recover oil and pick up oil, and frankly moves way beyond my pay grade as a national incident commander. And I know there are a lot of questions out there by the American public.
Boy, I should say.
Yeah, it's really, really different.
With a $75 million federal cap, I mean, it would seem that that's literally a drop in the oil bucket.
Well, under certain circumstances, liability is unlimited if there are certain if you can demonstrate negligence or some failure to meet some type of a standard. And I think all that will be looked at. But I also think that hopefully there will be legislation passed very, very soon that will reform some of those other limits.
Can you give us any sense whatsoever of what that letter from BP oil magnate Tony Hayward said last night?
Are you talking about the one on spill containment?
The letter you received back last night.
What we wanted, let me explain what's going on there right now. We've got a containment cap over the wellhead. And if you've seen the videos, it's not containing all the
right.
oil because we're concerned about increasing production slowly so we don't lose the cap itself. Last time when we put the cap on and it didn't work, we allowed water to enter it that mixed with the natural gas and created ice crystals called hydrates. And if you don't control the pressure, it will actually start what they call chattering and might lift itself off. So we're slowly increasing the production. It goes up to a vessel called the Discoverer Enterprise, and it's actually a production vessel. They flare off the natural gas, and they separate the oil from the water and the other sediments, and they actually are collecting it and then sending it ashore in shuttle tankers. We want them to be able to have enough capacity so we can close the vents on these containment caps and not have any oil leak, or whatever oil is leaking will be as a result of it. We didn't have a perfect seal when we made that cut a week or so ago. We're bringing a second vessel into place called the Q4000, which is a mobile drilling unit that will take oil off and flare the natural gas and actually flare the oil off as well. We're hopeful to establish a production capacity of 28,000 barrels a day. Right now, the production capacity is up to just over 15,000 barrels a day, and the capacity of the Ocean Discoverer is 18,000 barrels a day, so we're bringing the second vessel in. What we told BP is that's not good enough. What if one of those vessels has a problem or we stop production? We want a second set of vessels in place so we can handle the same amount of production capacity if we lose the other one. We want redundancy. And in the long term, we want more capacity. We want that to be redundant as well. So they're moving more ships. They're moving a large tanker from the North Sea right now to be able to put this is going to be a 1,000-foot shuttle tanker that will significantly increase our capacity. So we wanted two things. We want to have enough capacity to handle the flow, We want redundancy in the systems. And that's what we demanded in the letter. And that was a plan they provided back to us.
They provided that back to you.
They did.
All right. We've got lots of callers, 800-433-8850 to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, James. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane, and good morning, Admiral.
Good morning, sir.
On the Internet several weeks ago, I saw an article, or rather a little video clip, of two fellows in overalls with a demonstration of picking up oil using nothing but hay or straw from a farm. And that was some time ago. And later I heard that they had tried for weeks to get the attention of BP or the government to consider this, because the stuff really did absorb the oil and then left the water perfectly clean, and they could even burn that later as a fuel.
Was that tried, Admiral?
Actually, there are a lot of absorbents out there being used. If you go along the coastline, you'll see a lot of places where there are bales of hay that are lined up for miles. We also have other products, including cotton tubing that can absorb the oil, and then you just remove it. We have something called snare boom, which looks like a bunch of pom-poms that are connected by a rope. And as the oil comes through in the water, it just basically takes it out of it. So all those absorbent materials are all effective, but they need to be put in a place where they can be recovered easily. The best place for those types of equipment are either on a beach, where you have easy access, or against a hard boom where the oil can be pooled and then absorbed into those products. But that is a legitimate oil spill response. Bales of hay work.
James, thanks for calling. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Chevy Chase, Maryland. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning. I'm trying to find out a little bit more about where the line gets crossed with criminal and gross negligence in this matter, and what happens when now that BP knows essentially what the scope of cleanup should be and does not provide enough resources for it immediately to mitigate the problem, or doesn't provide a public calculation, transparent calculation about what is needed, where do they cross the line into gross negligence?
Let me separate that into two answers. Let's talk about negligence or criminal activity. There are two other activities are going on right now separate from the response, and I would just say as a person that's managing the response, I want to focus on that. There is a Marine Board of Investigation that was convened jointly by the Department of Interior and the Department of Homeland Security that has actually issued subpoenas and is holding hearings in New Orleans to establish the facts associated with the explosion and then the follow-on sinking of the mobile drilling unit and everything attendant to that, including the failure of the blowout preventer to activate. And as the Attorney General Holder has mentioned in the last week or so as well, they are taking a look from the Department of Justice on whether or not there's any criminal activity. I tend to section that out from what I'm doing because I need to keep focused on unity of effort, what we're trying to do to clean the beaches up. In regard to the amount of equipment they're providing or responsiveness to the spill, I actually have the ability to issue them an order. If they do not comply, there are criminal and civil penalties that are associated with that. And we've actually issued those orders. There is a problem, when you're talking about responsiveness, there is a problem on the national supply of booming equipment and skimming equipment. We are stressing the logistics supply chains. And another interesting issue that the listeners may not know about is, as a result of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, we require vessels, facilities, refineries, and drilling operations to have a certain amount of equipment there to respond to a spill. As we start using up the available inventories of skimming equipment and boom equipment across the country, we have the ability to remove equipment from one of those sites and bring it here, but then we have to grant them a waiver from their response requirements if they're going to continue to operate. So there's really a larger supply chain issue, and I think we shouldn't confuse their responsiveness with the availability, and we're working all those very hard.
But at the same time, on the question of legal liability or negligence, have you seen anything which would indicate to you that there is negligence involved?
Well, the response operations wouldn't necessarily demonstrate that, especially the causality associated with the explosion and what happened in that wellbore. I've had a personal conversation with Attorney General Holder, And I indicated to him that if any information was discovered or revealed in the course of the response that he would need to know about, I would call him immediately. None of that has surfaced in the response thus far.
I see. All right. Hope that answers it, Dennis. Let's go quickly to Dallas, Texas. Bert, you're on the air.
Yes. Whatever happened to the super tanker cleanup that was apparently effective in Saudi Arabia some years ago? I've never really heard a good reason why they don't at least get one out there and try it.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I've had that question several times. Let me answer it again here. First of all, there would be a time delay while the tanker was converted. They don't have a tanker that has the opening in the sides that could do it right now. What they were proposing was to actually take a tanker and make modifications to it. So first off, we would have some issues about the structural integrity and how they would handle liquid loading related to the modifications to that vessel. But secondly, and probably most important, it's not the same operating area. That was a large monolithic spill in Saudi Arabia. A massive amount of oil was concentrated in one location. What we've got is where the oil is coming up to the surface, on any particular day, there might be 20 to 30 vessels within 2 square miles that are doing drilling operations, remotely operated vehicles. The relief wells are being drilled. And the ability to operate in and around where that oil is coming up is very, very difficult.
Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen will take just a short break. When we come back, more of your questions, your comments. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Moynihan Report, released 45 years ago, described deterioration in urban black family life. A look back at reaction to the report and its influence on U.S. social policies. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And if you've just joined us, Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen is with me. He is, of course, National Incident Commander for the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. We're going back to the phones in just a moment. We've gotten a number of messages reflecting this one from Stephen on Facebook, who says, please ask about the New York Times story this morning, efforts to limit the flow of spill news, which says, in effect, journalists struggling to document the impact of the oil rig explosion have repeatedly found themselves turned away from public areas affected by the spill, not only by BP and its contractors, but by local law enforcement, the Coast Guard, and government officials. Why is that?
Thanks, Diane. I'm really glad you asked the question. I issued a directive, and it's posted on our deepwaterhorizonresponse.com website several weeks ago, just to clarify this. There are no impediments to media access to any place except for two reasons. If there's a security problem or it's a safety problem because of the volatile organic compounds or something like that, I made it very, very clear to my people. And if there's a problem that anybody has with that, they should go to that website and let us know about it. But my personal directive, and I've admonished Tony Hayward at the same time, we have to have access to these work sites. And as long as it's not a safety or security issue, they should have access.
All right. This story is by Jeremy Peters. It begins when the operators of Southern Seaplane in Belchasse, Louisiana, called the local Coast Guard Federal Aviation Administration command center for permission to fly over restricted airspace in the Gulf of Mexico. They made what they thought was a simple routine request. Pilot wanted to take a photographer from the Times-Picayune of New Orleans to snap photos of the oil slicks blackening the water. The response from a BP contractor who answered the phone late last month at the command center was swift and absolute: permission denied.
Well, first of all, I'd like to see if it predated my order and my conversation with Tony Hayward. Irrespective of that, what I would say is this. We have a lot of aviation assets out there that are doing scouting and directing the vessels out there as far as where the skimming and in-situ burning is going on. So there are some flight restrictions for safety right over the well site itself. Outside the flight restrictions that are imposed, that would be the case for almost any major operation like that. I'm not sure why there would be an access, and I'll take your I'll take the name and we'll follow up on
okay.
it there. But it is. Let me say one more time.
Sure.
Unless there's a safety or a security problem, and I don't know whether either one of those existed at that time, there should be access.
Congressman Ed Markey followed up with that, saying, quote, "I think they've been trying to limit access." He says he fought BP to release more video from the underwater rovers that had been filming the oil-spewing pipe. Quote, "It's a company that was not used to transparency. It was not used to having public scrutiny of what it did."
I've directed that all tapes associated with this, when they're needed for whatever purpose, be released by BP, and they've released them. I will tell you this, it gets a little convoluted, and I found this out myself, because the ROVs are actually operated by a subcontractor, and the issue of who owns the equipment and where the data's at and how you transmit it was a little more complicated than even I envisioned. We were trying to get high-quality video to be able to assess, try and make assessments of the flow coming out for the purpose of trying to come up with flow rate estimates. And we found out that what they were piping back and streaming was lower quality video because of the restrictions on the amount of data they could put over the satellite transmission nets. So we actually physically went out and got the disks of the data, brought it back, and put them on large servers so we could actually manipulate that data and get the flow rate. So it's a little complicated, but we've told them they have to give it to us, and they're producing it.
I gather it's complicated, but I also wonder whether you personally don't find yourself frustrated, angry, you know, at times ready to blow your top.
Well, if anybody that's involved in this, even watching it, the American public, is not frustrated or angry, then I think there's something wrong with them. This is a catastrophe. It's a human and a natural disaster simultaneously. Nobody should be happy about this. I'm not happy about it. I've worked on the water for 39 years. I'm in the Coast Guard. We're supposed to protect the man from sea and the sea from man. There's been an insult to the environment out there, and frankly, nobody should be happy. That said, it's going to take a lot of unity of effort to get this thing solved, and I tend to focus what I do on trying to bring not only the U.S. government, but the private sector, state and local governments together to achieve the best effects we can.
All right. We'll go back to the phones and to South Bend, Indiana. Good morning, Corey.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, Admiral. How are you guys doing?
Good morning, sir.
I'm just calling. I spent 7 years in the Coast Guard, and I wanted to congratulate Admiral on his term as Commandant and also a new beginning with Admiral Papp. But I was just wondering, I was on 225, and I was wondering if the Coast Guard, I haven't seen any publicity on it, using the ship's oil recovery system, at least getting training and video footage of that, because I think that it would bring light to what the Coast Guard does and how we can help protect the marine environment. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you for your service. Second, we are using them. We built a new class of what we call buoy tenders. These are the ships with cranes that actually pick up the buoys and replace them. We were building them when the Exxon Valdez ran aground and spilled oil. So the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 mandated that we create Coast Guard cutters with spill recovery capability. And in fact, all of our large cutters that have that capability are now deployed off of Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. So I would say to the caller, they're out there, they're in use. Maybe we ought to put a camera on them once in a while, but the Coast Guard's out there on job.
Here's a message from the DR Show website from Whitecrest. Why is it taking so long to get an accurate flow measurement? Woods Hole scientists have indicated this is fairly straightforward to do. They offered their services, which BP declined.
Actually, that's not true. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute offered their services, and the Coast Guard got in the middle there and said, how are we going to make this happen? They actually deployed some acoustic sensors down where the leaks were occurring before we cut the riser pipe, and we're able to make some volumetric estimates. We are reviewing their reports right now. We're going to bring that together with several other science-based estimates that we've come up with. If I could just maybe take a minute to tell you about some of them, I think it might be interesting. One method we're using is looking at satellite and sensors from airplanes that have flown over the top to look at the reflectivity of the water, and it's different with oil and with regular water. It can actually produce an estimate on the thickness of the oil. That's one way. The second way, we're actually looking at the flow itself with the video and trying to understand how much of the flow is natural gas, water, and oil, and between each frame, how far has it moved, and trying to estimate the cross-section, and from that get another estimate on the amount of oil or product that may be moving forward. And we've also got the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, which went down there and actually did sonar cross-sections on the density or the depth to try and come up with a volumetric measure of how the oil was coming to the surface.
So when you say the Coast Guard got in the middle of it, you're saying that BP did, in fact, refuse Woods Hole scientists initially.
No, I was actually in facilitation logistics. They had to put some very sensitive sensors out there. What we had to do was deconflict, and this may be not well understood too. At any particular time, there may be anywhere between 14 to 20 remotely operated vehicles within about 2 square miles on the ocean floor, either working with the relief rigs or with the cap containment cap that's going on down there. Just finding a spot to get an ROV down there, have an open area to be able to look at it, had to be coordinated because we don't want to stop the application of undersea dispersant or the other things that are going down there to mitigate the spill. So what we actually did, we got in the middle, we deconflicted the space, made room for them, facilitated them getting the sensors out and putting it down, because without that kind of intervention, the pace of normal operations, not a desire to help them, would have precluded them just because of the density of the ROVs were operating there. So we made some space for them.
How much contact have you had with the people along the coast?
Quite a bit. I spent about over a week's period of time. I may be half the time here, half the time down there. I've been to every state. I've been over to Houston to the BP command center. I've made 3 trips out to the oil rigs where they're drilling the relief wells. I've overflown the site many, many times. And I've been down there on all the presidential visits as well. And I'll be heading down next week.
We have an email from Brian in Ferndale, Michigan, who says, Admiral, looking ahead to the inevitable next time, what would you want to have in place to prevent a similar deep well disaster, to stop the flow quickly and clean up what's released?
I testified before the Senate a couple of weeks ago, and I made 3 recommendations. Maybe I can just restate them here because that's probably a good answer to the question. First of all, I think we need to look at how we inspect, regulate, and certify blowout preventers. This was supposed to be a fail-safe device that was supposed to close.
Yep.
Right now, the way they do that is they are constructed to an industry standard that's created by the American Petroleum Institute, API. Then they are certified that they were built to that industry standard. That certification is accepted, and they're allowed to be put in operation. I think ultimately we need a third-party inspection of blowout preventers, number one. Number two, I think the Coast Guard needs to take a look at its current regulations regarding how we inspect and certify mobile drilling units. This mobile drilling unit was actually registered. It was a foreign flag, and we issue what's called a certificate of compliance that the standards of that country are equal to the standards of our country.
And you're saying that's the responsibility of the Coast Guard?
Well, if I could explain,
okay.
There are international standards, and in this case, the Marshall Islands, which was the flag, issued a certificate of inspection. We then issue a second certificate of compliance where we go and audit their requirements, and if they're the same as our standards, we issue a certificate of compliance. I think there's an issue there about whether or not we ought to actually do a physical inspection. We do that now with cruise ships because of the number of American passengers that are carried, so that's another area we need to look at. And then as a result of that, I think we need to take a look at firefighting systems, the dynamic positioning system that actually control the position of the drilling rigs. And that's all part of a revision to Title 46 of the U.S. Code. We ought to look at that. The third area is the response plans that are required as a condition of operation for the Minerals Management Service should be reviewed by the Coast Guard.
You're saying the Coast Guard ought to be reviewing
the response plans for the oil rigs. Yeah, right now it's a responsibility of the Minerals Management Service, the Department of Interior. So the folks that ultimately would have to respond offshore, the local Coast Guard commanders, I think need to review those as well.
Minerals and management, it's been suggested, ought to be broken up into several divisions. Would you agree with that?
I would defer to Secretary Salazar. I think that's already being looked at.
Figured.
That's a little above my pay grade.
Figured. All right. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's take another call in Palm Beach County, Florida. Hi there, William. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I love the show.
Thank you.
The Admiral probably already answered part of my question when he was talking about the skimmers. I'm curious to know, there's this argument about plumes, but it seems to me that that's been established. There are these large concentrations of oil down below the surface. Is there a vehicle that can go out there and practically not just skim, but maybe do something like a vacuuming these things up and getting them out of there where it's concentrated?
Well, what we're finding out is the concentration of hydrocarbons is very low. And again, it's more like a mist or a cloud inside the water, and it's not very susceptible to any kind of recovery. Where we have in the past dealt with underwater recovery, it's been where the specific gravity of the oil was greater than the water and actually sunk to the bottom. We've had several challenging spills in the last 20 years or so where we've actually done recovery off the bottom of the water. This is so fine. Even though it's a density that can be seen and measured, exactly how you'll put a technology down there to recover that, I'm not really sure we've ever addressed that, and I think that will be one of the things coming out of this spill and how we might want to move forward in the future.
And finally, to Brunswick, Ohio, let's go to Anastasia. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess my main issue is the fact that no one took into account the possibility of this oil spill at this depth and how to deal with it. And it's astounding to me that after the fact, we're dealing with an admiral on the radio, you know, trying to figure out and make it such a detailed and such a complex issue that was never taken into account. But yet everybody wants to blame it on BP. But what I really think the issue is that the American public could care less where they get their energy from. You know, nobody cares about that until there's an accident like this. And even now, no one's talking about, you know, where are the renewable resources that we're going to start using for energy? We're focused on what if this happens again? What if this happens again? And I guess my point is, let's not have it happen again.
Good point.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. There have been a lot of initiatives in the last several years regarding renewable energy. And in fact, when I was commandant on the Coast Guard, we actually dealt with some permitting for offshore wind farms and looking at maybe even tidal energy. If I could just maybe shift focus on this just for a minute. While all this has been going on, in the last 6 months, I've been a member of something called the President's Interagency Task Force on Ocean Policy. They are getting ready to make an announcement on how we really want to manage the oceans in terms of what they call marine spatial planning. That's how you decide what happens where, almost like urban planning for the water column. It's been overshadowed completely by this response, but I think the administration is poised to talk about that. And I think when we talk about multiple uses, potential uses out there, we need to move to a larger paradigm on how we're dealing with management of the oceans.
One last question for you. We are in hurricane season now. What preparations can you make in anticipation of the worst?
Well, right now, the current production rig that we have out there is not acceptable for hurricane season. It's one we had to put in because we could get it there. Basically, we have a fixed riser pipe that goes from the wellhead to the production vessel. That's not a very good system for riding out heavy weather when you have swells in the sea state. That is going to be replaced over the next several weeks. What they're actually going to do is create a riser system that floats under the water that's anchored to the bottom of the ocean and that's connected to the wellhead by a flexible pipe. And then at the top of the riser pipe, which is, again, below the surface, it will be another flexible pipe that will go to the production unit. And they're going to bring a larger production unit that can withstand heavier seas. So if a hurricane were to come in, they could easily detach from the hose and then move away. What there still is going to be a problem potentially is there may be some discharge while they're off station before they can get back. But the plan right now is to put more seaworthy vessels out there and have a more flexible mooring so we aren't chained to the bottom during a hurricane.
And who owns all this oil that's coming up?
That's a good question. I'm assuming it's being produced, so I'm assuming it's BP. I haven't been asked that question before, but that's an interesting question.
We shall see. Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen, he's National Incident Commander for the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. There is a link to the Deepwater Horizon Unified Command website at our website, drshow.org. Thank you for your service. Thank you for coming in today.
My pleasure, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Reams.